Well, I had mentioned earlier before you came in that one thing I want to be able to be is available to people who want to write on the outside of this class, you know, and use the extras or whatever you need, and then show me poems when you see me at lunch or whatever. So that could work in too.
My name is Cressy Rice, and I grew up in Northwest Montana, and then I went to school in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for 2 years and cross country ski raced. And then this winter I decided that that's not what I wanted. I didn't know if I wanted to do it as much or how much I really wanted to do it. And the only reason I was there was because of skiing. So I decided to transfer schools, and I'm going to Mills College in Oakland, California next year. And that's going to be a big change.
Be more specific about Northwestern Montana.
Libby, Montana.
Okay.
I have one of my best friends from Northwestern. Libby. I'm still training. My whole life has been cross-country skiing. So my ordinary everyday things would be running by myself, then being with friends and training, and then the competitive side of it, and eating a lot of food, and trying to get enough sleep, and trying to balance skiing and school, and how much time do I want for myself? Do I want a boyfriend? Can I have a boyfriend? It doesn't work. And then what about school? And so those have been some things I've been struggling with. But I'm here from Evelyn for the summer.
Wow.
Working with kids.
My name is Gail Duggan. I don't live in Iowa now, but I have been in Iowa for many years. I'm from Sioux City.
Oh, well, we were in Sioux City 15 years.
Yeah.
How did you get together?
I'm going to say we'll talk afterwards. I'm going in just a few weeks. Right now, my husband and I live in Bangkok, Thailand. So it's very ordinary for me.
Yeah.
Opens all sorts of doors, your question does. That's just a very interesting thought. A lot of the things that, but I was really, you know, when I first started thinking about it, the first thing that came to my mind was the sun. You know, the sun's got to be, comes up every day, shines all around the world and so forth, but it does seem very special here. It feels so good, so forth. And then the other thing that came to my mind is it's certainly part of the way of life here, Holden, to recycle. But this has been the pattern is more developed and carried to a greater degree than any place else I've lived. So that what is very routine here is not
a regular
everyday event for me, and so on.
You might enjoy my composting exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm going to bird dog around and get more people, and our people have asked me for these handouts, so we might not be the only people giving this reading, but hopefully we're going to be giving a reading in the bookstore during the week. Is there someone? Come on in. You aren't going to write poems? So that'll be something to kind of work up to, and I thought, if you want to give me your poems during the week that you've been working on, my vision is that these will only be poems that we've written while we're here, you know, and then we'll give a good old literary reading in the bookstore, which would be fun. They want to do that. That was their suggestion, so that would be fun. So just whenever you see me, give me copies, you know, that I can look over for you if you want me to, or tell me what you're going to read so I know how much we have to work with. I have a friend who told me recently that these exercises, when I showed them to her, seemed to her like doorways, and I thought that was a kind of an interesting concept. So I sat down this weekend and thought about what colors these doors might be. So I came up with exercise 1 being a yellow door, and exercise 2 being a red door, and exercise 3 being a blue door, and exercise 4 being a green door. And the reason I chose those colors is that in exercise 1, the language is very important, like yellow, maybe the sun is on this language. Creating a mood is very important, and the meaning is clear, but that's not as important as in other exercises or in other kinds of poems. The meaning is subtle, and it comes through the language and through the objects and the mood. And in exercise 2, red door to me would suggest remorse or anger that needs reconciling, passion, assertion, meaning that is very clear but also subtle. And exercise 3 being like a blue door, which of course the color blue has been related through our culture through unhappiness at times, but also reflection and feeling sentimental, perhaps feeling loss, or even feeling a good kind of loss of loving someone. This could be like a kind of a letter to someone, a desire to communicate, to celebrate, even sadness. And then exercise 4 being a green door suggests to me that the meaning is less important, but that the seeing is something very different from something you've ever seen that way, as original as it can possibly, although they say there's nothing new under the sun, but people do have original ways of looking at things because we're all unique people. And if you have something that you can put in a poem that's different from something you've ever read or heard someone describe in that way, that to me would be like a green door where the meaning is very important, where the meaning is defined for the reader so that they understand how you see it. Those are the four colors I came up with for the doorways. And then I have an example of each of these from literature. So I thought I'd read one from each color, in my mind anyway. Exercise 1 being a very Holden-like poem by William Stafford. And that this is a yellow door, looking at things with mood and well, the language is very important, but it's subtle. It's subtle. Stafford is always subtle, but it's still clear if you can read his subtleness. And you probably can because he's accessible as well as difficult. Things that happen. Sometimes before great events, a person will try, disguised at his best, not to be a clown. He feels a great event is coming, bow down. And I, always looking for something anyway, always bow down. Once, later than dawn, but early, before the lines of the calendar fell, one of those events turned an unseen corner and came near, near, sounding before it something the opposite from a leper's bell. We were back of 3 mountains called Sisters along the Green Lakes Trail, and had crossed a ridge when that one little puff of air touched us, hardly felt at all. That was the greatest event that day. It righted all wrong. I remember it, the way the dust moved there. Something had come out of the ground and moved calmly along. No one was ahead of us, no one in all that moon-like land. Oh, I thought, how hard the world has tried with its wind, its miles, its blundering, stumbling days, again and again, to find my hand. Well, of course, these colors cross over, and these exercises cross over. I can see a number of other things in that poem. Well, Stafford's poems are so rich that they cross over all these things anyway. Exercise 2 is a Stafford poem, and it is a kind of a red door to me, but I have an example from somebody else for that too. And also a Stafford poem. But this is a kind of an assertion poem. A poem on the death of the man who invented plastic roses. It's by Peter Menke. The man who invented the plastic rose is dead. Behold his mark. His undying, flawless blossoms never close, but guard his grave unbending through the dark. He understood neither beauty nor flowers, which catch our hearts in nets as soft as sky and bind us in their web of fragile hours. Flowers are beautiful because they die.
So what's a red poem?
Well, you know, I'm playing with that. I would call it that. And this is a Stafford poem, which is also an assertion kind of thing. I don't know, I'm playing with that. We can play with that, and you can give me some input on that, too. With Kit, age 7, at the beach. We would climb the highest dune, from there to gaze and come down. The ocean was performing. We contributed our climb. Waves leapfrogged and came straight out of the storm. What should our gaze mean? Kit waited for me to decide. Standing on such a hill, what would you tell your child? That was an absolute vista. Those waves raced far and cold. How far could you swim, Daddy, in such a storm? As far as was needed, I said. And as I talked, I swam. Then I was thinking about the third exercise is a blue drawing, kind of a letter to someone. I ran across a poem that's very poignant. It has to do with separation. It's actually written by a person I knew as a novelist, Patricia Henley. It's called Poem for Charlie, 8 years old. Thanksgiving, we talk long distance. You are excited in the season's first snow. I imagine your chapped raw cheeks. I hear the barking dog staccato and almost smell the cold rolled in by your heavy winter clothes. Here the air is sheer warm gold, sweet with sunlight. Every day I walk to the post office and see the mountain, a blue bone. I want to show you the way it resembles a fine lady's hair comb. But we are apart, hearts sore and inhabiting one another's dreams. I have closed the door on your daily politics, the last-minute search for the lost reader, the noisy games. Over the phone, I say, I love you. Soberly, you answer, no, you don't. We are each alone. Stalemated, we hang up on the holiday. A mother who loves but leaves. I follow a path of question, amaze, solitary route of empty phone booths. And I think there's kind of an ordinary separation with children, too, that comes even though you aren't physically separated. And this is one of mine, the mother and son flute piano duet. Let me play that one note again I said was not enough. I want to dangle it from my index finger over and over with a rhythm you wanted from me as you ran muscular and light around its track on the flute melody you wrote. I'll be constant as breathing, count on my smooth ground. And then exercise 4, being a green or seeing something different. I have another poem of mine. It was a mountain poem, and I thought, well, at least I think I saw things differently. It's about Mount Shuckson, which is in western Washington. Shuckson. To see the whole mountain as peace, with only one peak in sunlight, and the foothills with trees straight up under the snowfields, is to see it as a sense of space. What has settled on the mountain is not its strength, but its softness. I could bury my forehead in it, and I have. The snow on my forehead was as warm as rain. A small tree was my shadow when I looked away. So those are some examples, and then I thought I'd have you vote, if you can look over the three doors or exercises, on one that we could do today, and you could spend some time working on, and then we could read some first drafts back. And this will be hard on the tape. I didn't think about that. Maybe we can do a lot of our thinking out loud, but if you wanted to kind of look over for a minute and see which one you would want to do out of these four, I don't know, we don't have time for all four of you.
So do we all need to do the same one?
Yeah, it would be helpful. And
yeah,
then
we're also okay.
Yeah. I would suggest the first one, and that has, you know, the easiest route into it. We could also, you know, do that a little bit and then go on to another one. That might be. And we might do this verbally rather than taking any class right of time, because that'll be silent. We can't be silent on the media. It just doesn't work.
I like the idea of looking at things differently. Is that exercise?
Oh, okay. Well, they all kind of overlap, but either four or two, yeah, that overlaps. Yeah, we were talking about composting. This is here's a good one. And we can use the first one to kind of work into it mentally, I guess. I didn't know I was going to be taped when I did these exercises at home, so I didn't think about the silence. But the idea of the first one is that, you know, you think of words and connotations to those words. And this is, you know, just a kind of an immersing in language after you've read poetry. You enter a kind of a different place. That's what Stafford used to describe poetry as. It's something that caused you to have a different kind of attention or a certain kind of attention. You have to enter that kind of attention. Some people do it by reading. Some people do it by sitting and, you know, just getting into kind of a state, listening to music or whatever they do. But it's a world of heightened awareness that you need to enter in order to write a poem, to want to participate in that world where you see things with heightened ability and the meanings behind ordinary things for yourself. So that's the idea behind that simple exercise of picking out words and then their connotations for you and using those to work into a poem. The one starting with Stafford's poem called The Gift, yeah, I think that would be good to do verbally out loud with each other. The other, you need some quiet writing time. This is a poem from one of his later books. Are you familiar with William Stafford? He's a very loved poet. He's now died. He died last August. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. Very loved poet and teacher. This is a poem he wrote later in life from a collection called My Name is William Tell. And I'll read this, and then I put the meaning of compost. I love doing that. I love looking things up in the dictionary. In fact, Nelson Bentley used to say if he was trapped on a desert island, that the book he would choose to take, you know, would be a dictionary. You could never get tired of the dictionary, which is true. But the meanings of words are very important, of course, to writing poems, because they have to be exact. You're working with words that are going beyond what you put on the page to people's memories, to their hopes and dreams from those words, and they have to be exact meanings. So compost is, from the dictionary, a mixture of decomposing refuse for fertilizing and conditioning the soil. Compound, and I picked a compound to mix or combine, to make up combining parts or elements, to settle by mutual agreement. I thought that was an interesting thing. Actually, that's a compound agreement, but I played with that in a literary sense rather than a law sense. To increase or intensify by adding new elements. Well, great, you know, that's what poetry tries to do. Compound leaf, just put that in, a leaf divider into two or more leaflets with a common leaf stalk. So his word compost is very important in his poem, and I thought that would give it a background. The gift. Time wants to show you a different country. It's the one that your life conceals. The one waiting outside when curtains are drawn. The one grandmother hinted at in her crochet design. The one almost found over at the edge of the music after the sermon. It's the way life is, and you have it, a few years given. You get killed now and then, violated in various ways, and sometimes it's turnabout. You get tired of that. Long suffering, you wait and pray, and maybe good things come. Maybe the hurt slackens, and you hardly feel it anymore. You have a breath without pain. It is called happiness. It's a balance, the taking and passing along, the composting of where you've been and how people and weather treated you. It's a country where you already are, bringing where you have been. Time offers this gift in its millions of ways, turning the world, moving the air, calling every morning, here, take it, it's yours. So now, what if your life didn't conceal an element of that composting for you, and you could see it, kind of pick up a leaf of lettuce or something, and find something you'd forgotten about, something that you put aside and want to think about, something that makes that life a richer mix that you can grow from. Put it in again. I was playing with that idea. Borrow Stafford's ideas in the poem to write a poem. It's okay to borrow people's ideas. That's a literary exchange that's been going on for as long as human beings have told oral stories to each other. We get ideas in conversation from each other that start what we say in conversation. It's a human connection. So don't worry about borrowing his ideas or sparking off them. And I thought, well, you could also use an element from nature you had missed before with that heightened scene, or take a line that makes an assertion from one of your own poems or from one of your favorite poets, or regard the assertion as a false premise. Write a poem making that false premise a moment that touches you in your past or that will touch you in the future. The exercise causes you to make reconciliations. Nelson Bentley, who was a teacher of mine at the University of Washington, said, poetry reconciles, resolves. So if we're going to do this out loud and rather than on paper, I guess what I would suggest that you do, if you want to, is go around the room again and maybe offer an element of composting in your life, that ordinary event from where you've been or how people or weather treated you. Weather is very important to Stafford, and it is here, how weather treats us. He actually made me feel, he put a compost element in my life that he made me feel something that I'd felt as a child in Alaska, that the earth loves us. This is a very simple concept, maybe, but it's very important to me that if we don't have good times in our lives, the earth loves us. You know, we can go out and get a feeling of comfort from the earth and its weather. So do you want to start? And, that's not fair to you. Do you want to go listen?
Start listening next time. Get the
Well, then just, you know, like sort of talk or say something and then let somebody else kind of continue.
Well, that's an idea. Sure. This is what we were doing in class writing, and you were writing down something that you could read to us later, except that we're going to be doing it by missing that step.
It's a lot easier to write it down.
Yeah, it is easier to write it down. Well, you could be writing it down.
Mm-hmm.
an element or okay, piece well, of
I'm just cut up. I'm just stabbing people. I've done this before. So.
Piece of cut up cantaloupe.
Surprise, the sun feels good. The heat, the warmth. And I don't know what to do with it, but where I'm coming from is that in Thailand, we always run for the shade. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm coming from when I say surprise, but I haven't gotten there yet.
And here, you always run for the sun.
Yeah, right. So that's why I say surprise.
Oh, yeah, that's great. I'm glad we started with you because that's the whole spirit of this.
Yeah, well, something I see differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, the part of the poem that talked about the one almost found over the edge of the music after the sermon, it kind of jug up. I was remembering last night that I've been to the same church since I was 2, and the smell of those candles after they're put out, the smoke that drifts into the congregation, and we always sat in the same pew right up front, and it would get to us before we start going out to shake hands with the pastor, and it was kind of a comforting. I loved that smell. It was one of my favorite smells. And then remembering my first communion and how my communion card would, I used to always draw on the communion, back of the communion cards and stuff, and play tic-tac-toe with my friends and make little pictures and stuff with my friends. And finally we got to really use them for what they were supposed to be used for on the front. So my community card was so crumpled, like folded in all these different places. It was just limp and hanging there by the time I finally got to go to communion my first time. I was so excited. And then just remembering being the acolyte and being able to be the one to put the candles out and being so nervous, okay, I step back, bow my head. I was supposed to say something, but I don't remember what it was. I was supposed to say something to myself. And putting the one that represents Christ out first and the one that represents God. And just all the memories of and trying to light the baptismal candle, and it's so big and so tall. It's always hard. But that smell always is and follows me. Other places.
So it almost had a mystery to, or there's something there that in the smoke that's kind of mysterious.
Mm-hmm. The smell follows you, you said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like here, it's the same smell. I don't let people blow out normal candles, it doesn't smell the same. It's those big white church candles. Lutheran candle.
Well, that's something that you've experienced that you can share that nobody's thought of before, you know. That nobody's, I mean, I didn't know that. And that could have a lot of meaning. Roots.
There are lots of things in this poem that touch my life. I guess I'll just start with the same image you mentioned earlier. The edge of the music after the sermon from a different perspective. In my congregation, I'm the one giving the sermon most of the time. But what ministers to me in worship is music, much in one of the deepest ways. And I find that becoming more and more so the older I get. I'm not quite sure why. I've always loved music, but I find listening to music to be, in many ways, much more spiritually moving and satisfying for me than giving a sermon myself. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because I need to be ministered to as well as to minister. And that my love of music does that for me. It also is one of my deepest frustrations when the music doesn't speak to me the way I had been hoping it would that particular day. Hmm. So you know, I really grooved on that one.
Huh. Wow.
And others too.
Uh-huh.
I say it's becoming stronger and stronger. The older I get.
Well, you need as well as I need it more. Need to give. Yeah.
I need it more. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful when I get it.
Are you thinking of words or?
No. I'm not talking. I love to sing hymns, mm-hmm. but I'm talking about music that touches my soul just by being felt. It's a real kind of praise.
Do you get that feeling from listening to Bach? Or?
Yes, but not only Bach. Marty Haubin.
Ah.
I get it from Marty Haubin.
Yeah. Last night I was really moved by that. That was a Marty Haubin song, just hearing the music. He has that very emotional. That would be great.
Last night after church, music kept going and we started dancing. And it was dangerous.
We just got here today. They reported a little bit about that at lunch announcement. Sounds like we missed something outside.
Well, it was kind of something that just happened. Mm-hmm. The drums kept playing. And,
yeah.
And Karen, that was the high cow, said, "I've never danced in front of an altar before."
Another thing I find is that a greater appreciation for music from other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And I get sometimes kind of bored with the old tried and true forms that I've lived with all my life.
Uh-huh. Huh. That's good. Got a chance to write it down.
I wrote down several things, so I won't talk about all of them, but the second stanza grabbed me. It's very poignant. Long suffering, you wait and pray. Maybe good things come, maybe the hurt slackens and you hardly feel it anymore. You have a breath without pain. It is called happiness. Another what he's doing here is defining happiness. And usually happiness is being a pot of a something, feeling of being joyful or something. And here, I think what he's saying is happiness is when you don't have pain. And I can remember our oldest daughter died a couple years ago. I can remember the first day that I didn't feel like I was wearing a neon sign across my forehead that said my daughter died. So that was the day I had happiness for that day. Mm-hmm. It was not being just feeling like somebody was stabbing me with a skewer.
Well, you can relate very closely to his experience then, because he had a son who died before he wrote this.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. How old was he?
He's in his 30s. Mm-hmm. Let's understand.
So, there's something there that...
Right, well, you related to that, so it must be true, you know.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, that's really
well, and I'm... There have been some other times in my life, or our life, when there's been trouble or suffering, and I can remember feeling like I don't necessarily want to feel happy. I just wish some of this garbage would stop, so I wouldn't have pain all the time. Mm-hmm. Makes sense too.
Yeah, and that second line, you get killed now and then, violent in various ways. I mean, that's very true.
But maybe he's right. Maybe he's right that's what happiness is when you don't have pain. Maybe.
Well, your poem could decide whether he was right or not, you know, or how, what degree he was right for you, you know, and you could jump off from that.
Like, sometimes we think, or some people think happiness is, but.
It's a strong assertion, I mean.
Well, it's kind of interesting the way it's stuck in the middle of this mm-hmm. poem, too.
He has a line in another poem after his son died, he wrote after his son died, about people saying to him, well, are you feeling okay now, or, you know, have you had time enough kind of to get over this? And his response in the poem is that he almost forgets it, almost, when he's listening to some music, almost.
Mm-hmm.
operate the what you're saying. And someone told me one time when the pain was great, it will get better. And another friend of mine said, I thought I'd never be happy again. So these happiness and pain sort of reminded me of that. And I mean, experience that it does get, like you say, less pain is happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I looked at this, it's a balance of taking and passing along. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably the oldest one here, and I look at the things that I've taken from other people and been a part of my life. And so the balance of being able then to give part of my life to someone else in, you know, various ways, I'm sure. And I suppose having the children kind of become part of that past that you had. Not being able to relate to it necessarily, but because they don't. But maybe there's something there they take and you pass along. My thought last night was that God is still working in the world. And I thought he's working through the parents who give that something of the love and they pass it on, which is ultimately God's.
Mm-hmm.
Balance there of taking things, because a lot of our life is just being taken from others, music wise, like you're talking, sermon wise, or smells that you've got through. This is all part of our life, and somehow life goes on like a flowing time, like an ever flowing stream. I forget what comes after that,
bears all its sons away.
There's a flowing.
It dies for balance. It dies for balance.
That's a dream.
Before the.
Dies at the opening day.
Dies at the opening day.
Dies at the opening day. That's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. The last I thought of the balance.
It dies at the opening day. What does that mean?
Time, like an ever flowing stream, bears all its sons away. It dies forgotten as a dream dies at the.
When you wake up, your dream is gone.
Oh, okay.
Things are fleeting to pass.
Is there something that you had put aside of this that you could remember to bring into this passing on? That you hadn't thought worthy of passing on before, but might have changed your mind? An event or a memory or an object that you'd forgotten to put in the
we're thinking what I can pass along, material, you know, the little things we were even talking about, special rings or, you know, but, and that in itself is something of yourself. And they were saying, well, you could sell it. She was just saying that today. He said, no, it's not the money, it's the preciousness of that thing that has been mine. That who do you pass it on to? And with it, you pass along the life of a gift. That sounds kind of funny. So I don't know, I can't think what I could pass on except parts of my experiences.
Uh-huh. Well, objects are very good sources of poems. You know, the story leading up to your receiving that object or what that object has meant, not just the object itself, is a very good source.
So I want to pass things on that have some meaning and maybe write some things down that...
Or about the person who gave it to you.
Yeah, that's part. Like yesterday was Father's Day, and so I wrote to my kids all about things that their dad had meant to them. Mm-hmm. Now that they don't have him to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Then I wanted them to remember. So I tried to pass along some things I saw in him as a father.
Mm-hmm. Well, the things people give us, they don't have to be materially valuable, are really wonderful indicators of who that person is, usually, you know. And just the story or the explanation of, well, I have that in exercise actually, but how that gift was given, what that gift was, and how that person came to give you that gift, it really tells a lot about that person and that you can pass on to, I think.
When you talk about passing on, I'm going to say something about her.
No, don't make it personal.
No. She worked with the Vietnamese family in Story City and had grammar classes for the parents and the children. And you wouldn't believe what that family, how they turned out and how these children had graduated from college. And I think a lot of it has been passed on through, you know, and the way she taught them, the things she did for them, and so forth. And they hadn't had that beginning, that start, where it would have been really difficult for them.
What about you, though?
I don't think I passed on.
But I do think that's, you know,
I don't want to put you on the spot. You just wanted to listen, but I bet you have things that you can say. Well, yeah. What would you? You know, that's a very practical thing right now because they're trying to preserve some of the things here that might disappear. You know, buildings will change, landmarks will change. What kind of composting has Holden given you that you value? What kind of objects and experiences?
Or your experiences and some of the things that have happened and so forth. I have no idea what this place was like. And I could document it at home and then what I experienced. And I don't think they would be inclined to come up here, you know, or be interested in a place like this, but that would be passing on to what they would see what it was all about. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a particular place here that is more important than another place, or you know, a particular time of day that's more important?
Only 2 days so
far. Oh, I thought you'd been here
before. Well, when you talk about, the atmosphere or the, you know, the way that, and the beautiful things of nature around here, and God's creation, the trees and the mountains and everything, windy and warm back home.
Well,
of course, as far as the, you know, the things we've done so far.
Mm-hmm. In the first exercise, I wanted you to use words and context of the words to go into a place where you'd been before and kind of look at that place newly because of those borrowed words. And I was thinking Holden would be a good place for that. Just going down, imagine yourself, or actually going down the road down here to where the trails start, and bringing with you language from other poets, ideas that you could bring in and see things in a different way. Just going down an ordinary, seemingly ordinary place that you've been before and thought you'd only seen it one way. Details that you could bring in from learning them from someone else. That's the thought. I don't know if you've had the experience, you probably have, of having little memory jolts, almost like you have a nerve ending that goes, wow, this reminds me of something else. That happens to me. I was down on the creek Saturday, and I got this, no, it was on the boat coming up here, on the Lady of the Lake. Well, that first I got a little memory jolt of watching the water and the wake behind my father's boat. Some of those are physical feelings of memory that you get. Those are really good sources of poems. And what poetry is a compounding, is a mixing of these things. What you bring, what you brought from other people, enriching this mix. So we're actually running out of time. So I'm going to go on to the next, the last two. So if you want to do these at home or at home, here we are at home during the week, and or whatever you want to do, just give it to me, and I'll be glad to go over it, you know, with you, like a critique, whatever you want me to do, make comments. I'm used to doing that for people, so I'd be very happy to do that. And also, if we can, you know, polish up some stuff and read it, I'll keep in touch with you. And maybe what you could do for me is sign where you live, you know, and what dorms I can find you or whatever, and then we can gather up people. We're meeting again on Saturday, but not till Saturday officially. So. But in the third exercise, it's just a simple idea. But story poems are really valuable, I think, because that's what we go to literature for, is to learn how to live. We don't go to entertain, we go to learn how to live. Good literature, at least. And what we can do to share our experiences is to tell our true stories so that other people can relate to them and feel that helps them. Thinking of a true story of your own life, and then it's been helpful in the past for me. I've taught a workshop at the University of Washington Extension called Workshop in Autobiography, and I've had people bring in stories that they always tell. You know, like you always have stories that you tell. Like if you meet someone, you think of some story that's always worked in the past for you, that is meaningful to you. It's a good story, you can tell it, it's funny or whatever it is. And you maybe tell it the same way, or close to the same way each time. That's a easy poem to write. All I do is just write it down.
What if they're always different?
Well, then it's growing.
You're too young to have that developed.
It's evolving.
Well, when I was two, I think girl.
Yeah, scars are real. I have a scar, yeah. I can tell. Yeah. Oh, I was riding up in the bus with the Maverick who got the chainsaw accident. You hear about him? You know, you're riding up the bus, you know, and he showed me his scar. I didn't even know him. He said, "This is like scar at Holden," you know, and it was still the
scar.
Stitches in it.
Still
scars are a very good source. But one way you can work with that kind of material is actually telling that story again to someone close to you or somebody you know, and then realizing how you're doing it at the same time, and then immediately writing that story down. And if it affects you emotionally when you tell it, like, you know, like I called my son in Virginia when this happened to me about my first getting SAS. This was fairly recently. And I read him this poem, and I started crying. This is a silly poem to cry about, you know. But it really affected me. The story, before I even wrote it down, affected me, is what I'm trying to say. So I knew it was a poem. And then use a title suggesting that, if you can, you know, like you've realized something about this experience. And then the last one is, I debated whether to use it or not, but it's kind of complex in a way. But the idea of gift giving, we were already talking about. I do like that idea, talking about gifts in poems. And gifts are very good sources of poems, describing some object or some experience that was given to you by someone else. And through that, describing the person who gave you the gift, because that happens. And mixing the elements of the giver and the gift, and writing a poem in appreciation that equals the gift. That's a real good thing about being a poet. You know, I've through the years, I've been very gratified to be able to thank people by writing a poem. This is something you can give back, you know. Makes them feel good, makes you feel good.
We're giving poems and gifts.
I made a necklace for all my friends, and I wrote a little poem explaining.
I used to do that with all the Christmas gifts I gave, but I got a little much.
This is easy with colors and the little beads I made.
So does anybody have anything to add before we...
Do you want something connected with Holden?
Sure, that'd be great. I mean, I think people would like that. It doesn't have to be Holden, you know. I mean, that would just be one thing we could work with. But people love to hear about places that are familiar to them. And it would give them a way of seeing it freshly. That's what poets do. They let people see things differently. That's the gift that they have to open up the world to other people.
How much do you want?
How long a reading do we have? I don't know. Usually readings are an hour. And they'll probably hollow out a little place in the bookshelves. I don't know where people can stand or
is
sit.
It going to be on Saturday?
No, it'll be during the week. I think. He didn't give me a time. But
this
I think
week?
If I suggest something, it would be good.
Okay.
Do you have a suggestion?
This week?
Mm-hmm. This is the only week I'm here, so... And then we can do Saturday after the, because that competes with the...
No, there's no lift.
Yeah, the lift. This would probably be an evening.
Like Thursday evening, maybe?
That'd be good, yeah. And then we could use Saturday as kind of a real workshop where we looked at things closely. My husband's going to be back, too, and he's a poet.
Will there be others, too?
Well, I think so, yeah, if we spread the word.
So all together to be an hour?
Yeah, I would suggest an hour.
We
so
could.
People feel like they've come away with something. If it's too short, you know, it doesn't make that much of an impact on people.
Why as much as you want?
I mean, I've gone to readings. Have you gone to readings that are so short that you think, like, okay, I'm, you know, I'm open now, but what else, you know? And then you go away.
If we can't do it, can we just listen?
Sure. We need audience. What is, somebody said, I guess it was some famous person said, there are no great writers, there are just great audiences, which is very true. Because it's communication, for sure.
Well, I know a gal in this camp that should have been here. She's done a lot of writing before she was here. She came with our group.
Another thing I think Holden brings with it is what I'm going through right now. I've made all these wonderful friends, and now they're going to leave.
Uh-huh. You can give them a poem before they leave?
Well,
or?
Yeah, but it's I met one of my best friends in the whole world here 5 years ago, and she's coming back with her family a week from on Sunday, and I'll get to see her again. And I've seen her every year. It's like it's really neat. But I was just so excited to come here. And now, and I have so many exciting things to look forward to when I leave, but, and I came here to, so I could meet all these neat people, and I've met all these neat people, I've really gotten to know them, and then they're leaving.
Yeah.
It's like, ah, you know, it's a really neat place to come, but it's really hard to leave,
uh-huh.
It's really hard to be here while people are, it's a big transition stage,
yeah.
At least for a lot of the staff.
In a way, it's almost like going to a too short a reading, where you're open, you're
right.
So open, and then you have to
over.
Go. Yeah.
What's a big transition for the staff, you said?
A lot of kids, well, like 20 through 30, 20-year-olds to 30-year-olds, basically. Like, I'm here, I'm in between things in my life. And a lot of people, this is a good place to come to spend a lot of a considerable amount of time. Giving things back. It's really neat. It brings people. And it's, I have a friend who's going to go to a monastery for 6 months. Leaves tomorrow. It's like, wow.
I was in the linguistics lecture this morning, and he was talking about monks who make vows of silence. But he thinks, and I'm sure it's true, that even though they've made vows of silence, they're thinking all the time, you know, that's still language, and that we think in a language that's different from our written language, which I don't know. I found myself kind of fighting linguistics ideas as a creative writer, but our thinking is certainly deeper than what comes out of our mouths usually, you know. We tell, it's like an iceberg, you know.
I know writing is a lot deeper than what comes out of my mouth.
So thank you for coming.
Thank you.
It's time for ice cream.
Yes. My friends
are on. I was going to say that at the beginning. It's 2 o'clock. It's time for ice cream, and you're here.